We're back with the Berlin Journal. Next up, we talk to Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc about her book Random Family and Rough Living in the Bronx. LeBlanc spent the spring at the American Academy constructing a book about comedians in New York City based on 6 years' worth of notebooks. Stand-up comics, she says, not only provided her laughs and psychological insight, but it forced her to think about her own performance as a journalist. LeBlanc spent over a decade with an extended Bronx family for her critically acclaimed book Random Family, published in 2002. A finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the work was named one of the year's 10 best by the New York Times Book Review. And in September 2006, LeBlanc received a MacArthur Genius Grant. Some critics said Random Family single-handedly revived American long-form journalism. In reporting for Random Family, LeBlanc entered the murky world of drug dealers, prison culture, crippling poverty, and the lives of two young women, Coco and Jessica. It all started when she approached a man nicknamed Boy George, a big-time heroin dealer in the mid-1990s.
Boy George, who's one of the main characters in the book, actually, there was a short piece about him in, I think it was Newsday, about his upcoming trial, so I just went to check it out. A friend called me and said, oh, you should check this out, this really young kid, he's on trial under this new law, the Kingpin Law, which was an attempt to prosecute higher-up drug dealers instead of the lower-level folks, so I just went to the courtroom to see what was going on.
And what were some of the details about his lifestyle that were fascinating?
Well, part of the reason he was even in Newsday was that he was one of the youngest, most successful heroin dealers. He was making millions of dollars. You know, at his height, I think he was making over $500,000 a week. He had over 30 employees. He'd figured out that heroin was a good bet during the heyday of crack. He was, unlike many young dealers, he was actually trying to invest the money into legitimate businesses. So he had a sort of scale of ambition that far exceeded, you know, most kids that were dealing drugs. And certainly, you know, his obvious entrepreneurial skills were striking. And he had this crazy, lavish lifestyle, you know, Porsches and parties and gold, all of that.
And did you approach him in the courtroom?
I did. I went, introduced myself. I had an assignment with Rolling Stone at the time just to do a straight profile of him and asked if he was interested, and he was. And then I just began to just show up. And it was through that time in the courtroom I met his girlfriend Jessica, and Jessica introduced me to Coco, and Coco introduced me to Caesar, and it all went from there. But it began as a very straight-up story.
How did they accept you?
Boy George had an incredible ego, as you can imagine, and I think he felt at the time that perhaps the story would help him. In some way, it would redeem him. It was not, he was not admitting that he was dealing drugs. His defense during the trial was that he was a jewelry dealer, and we made an arrangement that if he was not convicted, then I wasn't going to be able to publish the story. But if he was convicted and then lost on his appeal, then all the information that he'd given me directly about his illegal business I could use, which of course took years. But the girls were much more welcoming. I mean, I think they were vaguely curious about me. It was fun to have someone around who was following them around from a newspaper. But pretty quickly, they would not forget about me. I just wasn't that central. They were young teenage girls living their lives, you know. I don't really think I meant that much, in a way. I was a nice person that was around.
Did that change over the years? I mean, you were with them for a decade, right?
Yeah.
Did that
it certainly
change
changed.
Into a friendship?
It
or
did.
Something more intimate?
A friendship in my book, but a complicated friendship for sure, because it's not, or maybe friendship isn't the word at the... It's hard to say that I think friendship involves an element of reciprocity, and there certainly was a lot going on between us. We were both giving things and taking things from one another, but it wasn't, I guess, a conventional friendship in that regard. And the tricky part for me was how to preserve their freedom to reject me over time as we became more close. You know, because when you've been going to someone's house for 5 years, it's harder for them to say, could you excuse us? We'd like you to leave now. But, you know, even though I was there as a journalist and a family friend by that point, it's much easier if a journalist is there for a week for someone to say, do you mind stepping out? Or actually, we don't want you to come with us to the courthouse or whatever. So, but I think I probably was more worried about that than they were. I can't even say the main principal characters were frustrated with me overtly much. It was more peripheral people that were suspicious sometimes or uncomfortable if I was there, and I would always defer to that discomfort and leave. I mean, I never wanted... I felt uncomfortable if neighbors came over and they were uncomfortable that I was there. I would find an excuse to go outside or take a walk or whatever.
That very issue of discomfort that comes up brings up the sort of larger point about how these moral issues that have been written about before. And we've talked about earlier projects like A.G.'s and Evans' Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, being in Hale County, Alabama, in Road to Wagon Pier by Orwell. There's always the observer and the observed, and you have sort of class differences and race differences, obviously, and it's been written about a lot. Is this something that became heightened in any way? Was it something that was always in your mind, the sort of white privilege versus other classes, other races, etc., that's sort of integral to documentary?
After the book was done, I certainly began to have sort of full assault of that consciousness, both because people were demanding me to think about it and because all of a sudden it became this object in the world where these people that I know became characters and my experience became a project and all that. Of course it was also those things. I'm not saying I wasn't aware of them, but I don't think of it that way. But I guess for me, the moral questions aren't journalistic. They are more like, well, I'm writing about poverty that's been around for God knows how long. Isn't that the problem? Or when people would say, well, you know, didn't you do anything about, you know, she didn't have food, didn't you do something? Or when she went to hit the baby, didn't you do something? And I think, you know, how could you sort of do that? And I think, well, how can you? I mean, I gave 12 years of my life to documenting this. What, I mean, maybe I should have brought a pack of Pampers or something, but what are you doing? You know, what are you, why is this the location of that anger or that frustration? I understand it. There is a connection, but it to me is very much about the inability for us to stomach the implication of what it means that this exists and that it's painful and it's uncomfortable. And
when the book came out, these things became objectified and abstracted, right? and there they are. Why do you think that the focus then lands on these issues that maybe you have not thought about?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the readership, because very different events that I attended or readings that I gave or reading groups that read the book responded very differently. So there was a fairly consistent, I'm generalizing, academic response to the book, which almost inevitably led to the question of race privilege. Like, I never had that question anywhere but in an academic environment. That was like the first question, and that went on. And I did get to the point where I would stop talking about it, because I said, I can actually role play all the questions that will come and I'll answer, and I'll happily talk to you about this after the lecture, but I'm just not going through that drill anymore. Not because I don't think it's important, but in fact, it has nothing, I mean, I can't bring anything new to it. And I sort of feel, look, I would rather talk about what the book brings up. And I will happily talk to journalists about that experience. But it's not where I'm most uncomfortable, in the sense of it's not being a white person in a Hispanic neighborhood. That sort of isn't the way I experience my time there, you know.
Yeah.
But in other audiences, you know, audiences, say, in communities that were more akin to the people that I wrote about in the book, there was much more, interestingly, much more questioning around what could be done about the problems. You know, in the sense that people came forward with their stories and said that they too had these experiences, and in the feeling of seeing them systemically, what could be done. And I thought that was an interesting, you know.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. We're speaking with journalist Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc.
I want to jump into sort of what you're working on now. So you spent some time at the Academy, and the project that you're working on is about comedians in New York City.
Yes. Stand-up comedians.
It's a jump, but where are things now, and how did that come about?
Well, the stand-up comics came out of, I guess quite directly from my interest in trying to talk about the sexual abuse of boys, that there was some of the characters in the book that had been sexually abused, but I wasn't able to really get into that in the book. And there was a comic who just so happened to address this issue in his act. Somebody told me about it. It's how a lot of my stories start. My friends will always say, hey, Adrienne, I know you're interested. I always let everyone know what I'm interested in. And if you ever hear of something, let me know. So people say, oh, there's this guy. He's talking about sexual abuse. He's a guy. I went to see him, and I got interested, and he was a stand-up comedian, and then I began to follow him around for an assignment, and then it very quickly became a book. I think also it's very much a book about a man's world, and I think Random Family, for the most part, while men are extremely important, clearly, it was quite a bit of a woman's world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of the book as a time in my life in a world of women, and certainly this last 6-year stretch has been the men's zone, I think.
And how long have you been working on the comics project?
I started reporting it, I think, at the end of 2002, and this book came out in 2003. I was just finishing the copy editing and the final edits of Random Family, and I've been writing this book, I guess, for the past maybe 6 months. So 6 years? 7 years? Oh, God. 7 years.
Do you feel more active in this?
Much more active.
In this role?
Yeah, and it feels like a role. I mean, that's the other interesting thing, is I think I've labored under the illusion, or needed to labor under the illusion, that I, in fact, was just being myself out there in the world. And this book has really made me think hard about whether or not that's true, because I feel as though it is a role. And that's a very uncomfortable thing for me.
Has their performativeness made you more aware of your own, or do you feel like you've had to compete with them in a sense? Because comedians...
I'm smart enough to know I can't compete, and but I feel very interested in the dynamic between authenticity and performance. So, for example, when I... Like, you know, you and I have this conversation, and you talk to me about this thing you're thinking, and then, you know, 3 days later you're on stage and it's a bit, right? It's a joke and you've been working it over. I remember the first few times I felt a little betrayed. I thought we were having a real conversation, and there you are working your bit. And then I realized, well, that's what comics do, actually. That is how they work their bit. And why does that feel a little disheartening to me? And then it made me think, well, is this connected to what it feels like to talk to a journalist, which is you and I can have this really great conversation, but then I go home and I actually write an article about it. And so I'm very interested in trying to have the book both certainly tell a narrative story about stand-up comedy and implicitly be a meditation on the role of the journalist as a performer, maybe, or as a thinking observer. Ideally, I'd say a double profile, but it might be too ambitious.
Has there been anything, I mean, you're writing about comics, has there been anything actually funny?
A lot, yeah, I've laughed a lot. No, it's less funny than one would imagine, unless you know comedy or comics, then you would not imagine a lot of fun. But, you know, a lot of laughs. And I have become a much more irreverent person, and I think quite a bit more aggressive in teasing. And I mean, the comics often refer to the civilian world. I sort of think, you know, I've got to sort of rein it in a little bit, because you just are used to people commenting on anything freely, and that you're supposed to take it, and you actually do take it, because you don't take it so personally.
Did your experience that you're having now, so you feel a little more, you feel a little looser, etc., what's the difference between what this project is doing and what your first project did?
Well, I think that project made me, my sense of my own voice and my own opinion recede in a way, both out of respect for being taught about this world from the people that were allowing me to write about them. It was a profound humility that I really had nothing to throw into the pot, if you know what I mean, because I was watching people who had survived adversity for a hell of a long time, and on top of just managing that, were allowing me to figure it out and show me what was going on. So there wasn't a lot of, like, my voice or my opinion or my presence was a subordinate one in a way. And in the comedy world, while I don't exist as me, Adrian, in a specific sense, I exist in the role of an audience. So I'm always called upon to listen and respond. And that has stirred up the desire, actually, to speak and have an opinion and say something. And that's interesting, because I was quite proud of myself for having, you know, this lack of a need to insert myself into people's business. I don't feel like I want to give you an opinion on your life, but I feel quite hungry to chime in.
So thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal, and we'll hope to see you back in Berlin, Adrian.
Thank you.
After the break, the darkly humorous world of novelist Donald Antrim.
Create the ultimate smart car. On your way home today, take All Things Considered along for the ride. Keeping up with the news of the day might seem like one big detour, but don't worry, we know all the back roads. From Chengdu to Chillicothe, from Karachi to Kalamazoo, from Washington to Wasilla. All Things Considered from NPR News, your shortcut to the world.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal. Donald Antrim is the author of three novels, Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist. His style is a combination of a creepy surrealism, self-analytical intensity, and extra-dark humor, and it's all smattered with obsessive psychological charm. Antrim is a frequent contributor of fiction to The New Yorker magazine. He has spent the last 3 months at the American Academy working on a 10-year novel in progress called Must I Now Read All of Wittgenstein, about his father's book on T.S. Eliot. Antrim's most recent novel, The Verificationist, follows a group of psychotherapists as they meet to talk shop at an all-night suburban pancake house. But Thomas, the narrator, just cannot stop hyper-analyzing his meal.
We eat pancakes to escape loneliness. Yet within moments we want nothing more than our freedom from ever having so much as thought about pancakes. Nothing can prevent us after eating pancakes from feeling the most awful regret. After eating pancakes, our great mission in life becomes the repudiation of the pancakes and everything served along with them, the bacon and the syrup and the sausage and coffee and jellies and jams. But these things are beneath mention compared with the pancakes themselves. It is the pancake, pancakes, pancakes, that we never learn to respect.
So, firstly, thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Thank you.
The narrator of The Verificationist, your most recent novel, is a middle-aged psychotherapist in a relatively bland town who meets with some professional colleagues at a pancake house one evening. This innocuous and sanctioned act, eating breakfast for dinner, brings up a question you seem to deal with repeatedly, the burlesque. Is this a repeating theme for you, and what do you make of it?
Well, I've never really thought of what I do in relationship to burlesque exactly, though I do think about it in relation to farce and to farce structure with all of its sort of high-low potentials. I've been reluctant to think of what I do as necessarily satirical. I think of satire as specifically related to specific problems in social or political or cultural life in some way. And for me, it's really more important simply to feel that I'm, at least it was when I was writing these novels, this novel in particular, it was more important to me to have fun. I wanted to enjoy myself, and I wanted to entertain, if I could, through entertaining, as it were. So I didn't have any particularly deliberate need or desire to highlight the culture. I just found that there was a kind of a good comic edge and sort of payload, I suppose, at the same time. For me, anyway, there was a pleasure involved in moving a group of psychoanalysts into a kind of quotidian realm and then sort of watching what would happen, you know, as it goes along. I mean,
there's a scene in the verification, sort of the big scene is this out-of-body experience that the main character has, and he floats, he gets hugged by Burkhardt, and he floats to the ceiling. But in your memoir, In the Afterlife, there's also a scene of a floating to the ceiling moment. What's the connection there?
Well, you know, this novel, like the other two novels, proceeded from a kind of an initial idea or conceit that wasn't really an idea. I mean, this really began with the first sentence, which is, the pancake suppers were my idea. And that was really all I had. In fact, I sort of wrote it down while I was halfway through the novel that preceded it, and then put it all away for about a year and came back to it and began writing, but without any idea at all what it was going to be or where it was going to go or where it was going to take place or who these characters were or who this narrator would become. So really it was very much a kind of page-by-page building of a scene and a scene and a scene, and then bringing the world together, as it were, little bit by little bit. And then finally, there's a food fight early on in the book, and I do remember this distinctly, that when the character Bernhardt picks up Tom, the narrator, I just really didn't know what to do, and usually I don't know what to do, but I didn't really know what to do. And so I walked around, and I waited, and I thought about it, and it occurred to me that maybe he'd be in Bernhardt's arms for the entire book, and I still didn't know what that meant. So I really had to take some time off and come back to it. And it began to be a challenge or a technical problem that was so intriguing and seemed so difficult that, well, what could be better, right? So when he begins to dissociate and go up into the air, when he goes up to the under the pancake house ceiling, I think the idea of floating out of the body has some meaning to me, but I'm not sure that I'm really fully ready or able really to articulate the meaning. Though you're right in saying it does occur. I mean, it's occurred a few times in what I've written.
Well, let's pan out for a second. And the previous novels in Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World and in 100 Brothers, as well as in The Verificationist, the main characters are all sort of middle-aged white men. And I'm wondering, just as from your vantage point, what this generalized social character has lived through in the last 50 years. It's sort of both the most present story, but also one of the most invisible sort of inwardly. And it seems to, it's something that you return to a lot, I'm wondering.
I haven't really thought about it in exactly those terms, as if maybe as a writer I should be dealing in other groups, you know? I mean, I wound up, when I started Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, I've been writing short stories, and I had in fact been trying to sort of write characters at different ages and different ways and different kinds of places. But I was also writing dutifully. For a number of years when I was in my 20s, I had a kind of a strong conception of what a story should be, what a writer would do. You know, I just had a kind of anxiety about writing in general, and the anxiety was pretty huge. And eventually it shut me down. I wasn't really getting pleasure out of the stories I was writing. They weren't really succeeding as stories. But, you know, I wanted to write stories and send them out and write more and send them out because I wanted to keep the kind of reciprocity process going. I wanted to hear back. I wanted to, I didn't want to be too alone with what I was doing for too long. Anyway, when I was around 30, I stopped writing for about a year because I got very wrapped up and sort of tight with depression and a kind of large anxiety about just the prospect of ever making anything in writing work. And I got out of it by starting the first novel, which began with a narrator who I didn't really think of as me in particular, but who was obviously, maybe looking back, kind of a version of me or potentials. But more to the point, I was having fun. It was the first time I was really having fun. I got to the point where I thought, you know, I'm not getting paid for this. No one's asked me to do it. You know, it's not like your family says, you know, will you be a writer? So I couldn't really, you know, I had to have a reason to do this. I had to have a reason. And so enjoying myself in some way and building these sort of card houses of novels became the way I did it.
What was more pleasurable about putting a novel together versus putting these short stories together?
Well, I didn't really want to write a novel. I mean, I was horrified when I realized that maybe I thought I was, you know, because I didn't want to go for a year or two or three without any kind of response. I thought, how am I going to handle that? I mean, I was very, very, very anxious about all this. I mean, you know, I still am. I get very anxious about it. But finally, what happened was, after fiddling around with these pages, these opening pages of this first novel, this would have been about 1991 or something like that. I was around 30 years old, 31. And I'd been in a kind of funk of dread over the prospects. And one day I was on the street, I was living on the Upper East Side in New York at the time, and I was on the street and I was walking up 86th Street or something. And there really was a moment that I could almost describe as, it was almost spiritual in a way, the feeling anyway. I was so happy to have this thing in my life, to be thinking about it, because I understood that then that I was just thinking about it all the time, I was carrying it around with me. And I looked at the people on the street and I wondered and I thought, do you have something like this? It really was, it really came in a moment, it really came in an hour one day. And it was a kind of a shift or change in me being me in some way. And I wasn't as afraid of it anymore. And I thought, well, if this takes years, it's going to take years. So that's great, you know. This is going to go with me. It's going to be with me. It's going to be in the car. It's going to be on the train. It's going to be in the house. It's going to be on the street. When I go out on my bike, it's going to be with me. And I think that was the first time that had a sort of a comprehensive sense of pleasure, not just as the sort of momentary enjoyment or that comes with a good writing day or the satisfaction that comes with writing something that's really funny and you know is going to be, you know, is going to work or getting through more pages or something. This is a larger kind of overarching sense that something in my life had been, something had been added.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. We're speaking with novelist Donald Antrim.
So let me switch gears for just one sec. You've spent the last 3 months here in Berlin at the American Academy.
Yeah.
How's your experience been in Berlin, and do you want to come back, and what's been different here versus back in New York?
You know, I tried to write about this very, very briefly for one of the papers. I've never lived abroad before. I've been abroad, and certainly not in Europe. So the experience has really been very powerful. I had a lot of culture shock, and I had a lot of anxiety, as I always do. Also, it was the middle of the winter in Berlin, and it was very gray and dark. But as I began to know the city a little bit, you know, I've only scratched the surface, I felt that I could really feel this place in some way as a living place. You know, its history is so powerful. and so recent. If you're an American who's not been here, but who's read, watched film, and you know, you can have a sense that you know something about the World Wars or what we call the Cold War. But to be here, and for me to be here for the first time, is to give all of that sense of knowing something or thinking that I understood something a different kind of tactility or a different kind of reality. It's a real presence. You know, you can come here, I think, and have a kind of love-hate relationship in some ways the way you might in a city like New York. It's not a charming old capital. It's not clear what this city is to me, but there's a kind of ground-level excitement that may have less to do with cultural offerings that the city is so famous for, though couldn't exist without them, probably. You know.
I'm going to ask you one last question, because while you were here, you're working on a novel in progress, part of which you read before an audience at the American Academy called Must I Now Read All of Wittgenstein?
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell listeners, I know it's tough to summarize this sprawling project, but I wonder if you could give us a sense of what's going on there.
Well, I can't. I really can't. You know, I think maybe the place that I'm at and have been for a long time with this novel, because this novel was begun about 10 years ago, and I put it aside to write an actual memoir, but this is a novel which posits, I suppose, a son ostensibly learning about his father, meeting his father, finding his father through a book written by his father, a book about T.S. Eliot, which also bears on the philosophers who influenced and or lived around the time that Eliot was writing Proof Rock and The Wasteland and so on. But it's still early in the manuscript, and I've sort of gone forward and come back and gone forward and come back, cut things back and gone up a lot of alleys. And maybe what's happening is that I'm at a place that's a little bit comparable to place, as it were, early in the manuscript again. It's comparable to the moment when in The Verificationist, when Bernhardt picks up Tom, and then the writer just doesn't know what's going on. I don't really know what's going on here. I mean, what I hope to capture, what I got here sometimes, some days, was not a sense of knowing what it was, but a sense that it exists, or it will exist, or can exist. And that's a sort of a kind of an overarching trajectory that you can't really see. It's like a rainbow. You see it for a second, you know, but it's insubstantive in terms of sort of direct or conscious knowledge. I've had that here. I found myself being altered by being here. So I think I need to go home and and debrief myself a bit on living abroad and living in Berlin, and on the nature of what happens next, not only in this novel, but, you know, after writing The Afterlife, after writing the memoir, what happens in a novel, or what happens in any novel, for me anyway, as fiction approaches what I remember to be life, and as life and what I remember to be life impinges on fiction, and what that means emotionally and so on. It's hard for me to say right now, so I'm hoping that if I go home, I'll sit down and little by little, this very powerful trip will begin to assemble itself. And maybe it will turn out that I know more about this book than I say, or than I can know. And I'm hoping. I've got my fingers crossed. So that's my answer, I guess.
After the break, painter Amy Sillman worries and laughs her way through Berlin. We're back with the Berlin Journal. Amy Sillman began her life as an artist quite far afield. She studied linguistics and Japanese. After graduating from the School of Visual Arts in 1979, Sillman hung around with experimental filmmakers during the 1980s in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where she still lives today. Sillman describes her work as broad, colorful canvases layered with amorphous shapes, quasi-figures, and diagrammatic patterns. They are improvisational, erased, destroyed, and rebuilt, she says. She sits down with Kerstin Stackemeyer from Carly Gebauer Gallery in Berlin to discuss her work.
You have been in Berlin now since January 2009, and your exhibition at Carly Gebauer opened in the beginning of May. How was that time for you? I mean, like in relation to working on the show and now having the show put on? in Berlin?
Well, January and February were hard because I got here and the materials and the canvases and the stretchers and the paints and the drying time and the oils and the tools and the room and the humidity were completely different from New York technique expectations. So I couldn't figure out when things were going to dry or what kind of canvas to use. I got all the stuff prepared in advance. I spent a fortune having canvases stretched and had them made ready for me because I thought, I'll hit the ground running and I'll have lots of work really quickly. And then I got here and the stuff that they had given me was poorly done and lumpy. I mean, it was insane looking. And then I sent it all back. That was an interesting experience to learn about techniques of negotiation with German craftsmen. So I said to the guy, like, these are completely insane and totally wrong. And he said, oh, okay, I'll just do them again. And I was like, oh, but you did them already. Isn't that a lot of work? And he went, no, it's okay. I knew they were bad when I sent them out. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, they looked a little weird. And I was like, okay, why don't we do them again? When will they be ready? Oh, 3 weeks. Oh, God. It was so awful. Anyway, then I had a couple of them that were the ones that I had started working on that were where I realized that they were terrible. And they became like these wrestling devices. They became like wrestlers. They became like pro wrestlers that I was going up against every morning. So basically, I would like strip down and start attacking these giant lumpen canvases that were absolutely hideous with my hands, scraping the canvas with my fingers. And then I would go into the gallery every day, incredibly depressed, and attempt to cancel the show. And the gallerists would take me out in this very sweet way to the local place, and they would go, it would be very problematic if you cancel your show. And I'd be like, yeah, but it would be more problematic if the show sucks. And then they would very gently persuade me to go ahead with it. January was difficult. But then February was great. In February, I got used to it. I got new canvases. I realized, like, forget it. I'm not staying in the city. I don't need to. I'm perfectly happy in Wannsee. I learned the Regionalbahn. And then I was like, what's the big deal? It's about as far away as going to Brooklyn. Have these people never been to Brooklyn? Do they only live in Manhattan? They were all like, you went to Wannsee? And I was like, yeah, it's 15 minutes from here. So I was like, let's just live in the really comfortable place. Although there was one night where I was rushed by a pack of wild boars. Yeah, I got vilchfined. That was exciting. Did you know that? I was coming home really late from Basso one night. At 4 in the morning, and it was snowing gently, and it was beautiful out, and I took a cab, and I got out of the cab, and the cab driver, just as I was stepping out of the cab driver said in this super terrified voice, shut the door! So I stepped back in, and like this giant herd of like angry Wildschwein galloped up to the cab and kind of put their hooves on the cab and then ran down the street, because I think they were afraid that I was coming too near to their baby. It was extremely exciting. I mean, I sent people back in New York letters about this, a long set of emails, and they said, where do you live? We thought you lived in Berlin, but like wild animals are there? Like, we don't really understand where you went.
Yeah, Berlin is not that civilized after all.
I guess so. Anyway, so I had all these kinds of, like, I had animals and different experiences, and then it was fine, and then March I worked really hard, and April was kind of deadline, you know, work really hard, and then May the show. So it worked out fine. It was probably good that I had a deadline.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal on NPR. I'm Kirsten Starkemeyer talking to Amy Solman.
I think the show came out really well. Mm-hmm. And basically the next day after the show opened, I was like, that's great. I'm really proud of it. And I don't give it another thought. Mm-hmm. But when I do something wrong, I basically spend a couple days agonizing over it because I know in my heart that I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I understand totally if it was wrong for you, if you would have wanted it to be something else.
I think that all of the work that I do has to do with really believing in the idea of doing something and then responding to it. And the response might be driven by instinct and kind of weird formalism where I'm kind of like, I don't think this looks right, you know, and trying to kind of study it formally. But it's also, I think, really emotionally just about wrecking stuff. I really think it's about wrecking stuff. I think it's just like about making something and then thinking like, good, you know, I'm not interested in a kind of aesthetic experience. So it may look nice. It has really nothing to do with what it looks like at all. It has to do with like kind of trying to like force an object to be in a relationship with you. I mean, an inanimate object. So it's basically about falling in love and breaking up and falling in love and breaking up and falling in love and breaking up with an object that is inanimate. And later I realized while I was on this trip, I'm in love with my paintings. I mean, I love them. I'm in love with these objects. Mm. They're actually like the center of my emotional life, which is a little sad.
But a very productive one.
It's a very productive one if you want to... You know, be a painter, but it's also probably explains why, like, I was thinking the other day, oh, when we hung the show, I got really angry and upset. Then when there was, like, some kind of, like, collector drama, I got really angry and upset. And then I went into the gallery and I was like, you know, you've seen me be happy, scared, nervous, funny, giddy, silly, loving, hating, weird, scared, neurotic, anxious. You've seen every mood I have. And then I thought, like, God, what a drag to be my dealer.
I think it sounds fantastic.
They really don't want it. I think they're just like, bring us the goods, drop them off, and go away. And I'm like, no, but we're in a relationship. And it's kind of a stormy relationship.
Let's discuss this. Yeah. When you came to the gallery and you first spoke to me about where you're coming from and how you were working, you were saying that most of the people you were closely related to in like the last years in production were more video filmmakers, but not so much painters, or more the other way around, like painters weren't your primary reference in terms of people who are close to you in your New York life.
Yeah, because I went to art school in the 70s, and during that time, there were lots of painters, and there were lots of people who were doing painting, but I would say, I guess, among the more, I don't want to say radical or advanced, but I want to say, like, the students who were more dissatisfied, I suppose, and were trying to find active, critical kind of practice. I hate that word, practice, but I don't know any other one. Those kids... I think they sort of drank the Kool-Aid, basically, which was the Kool-Aid that said, painting is a dead, old, white, straight man practice. And paintings are the kind of glorified trophies that hang on the walls of, like, rich people's houses, and, like, who would want to participate in this kind of circle jerk, basically, of, like, mutual glorification. So that makes total sense to me, and I was friends with all of them, and I was interested in the idea of, like, doing something that didn't feel, like, very, very conservative, but I just wanted to draw. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's just a very simple, straightforward kind of statement. Like, I liked to draw.
In not taking that position, you take painting very serious as a practice, so if we look at the zine which you produced, maybe to come back to that, for the Zum Gegenstand show at Kali Geber. That's very much about how you work in detail. Maybe you can say a bit about, like, the text and...
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, what was really invaluable for me about coming here was having this grant and having this time to work was that I was able to solve a really serious problem that I felt like I always had, which was, how do I make paintings and engage with what seems like, I'm not going to call it critique or anything. I'm just going to say, like, a kind of feisty practice that doesn't just feel like roll over and accept capitalism in all of its glory. You know, so what do you do with your desires, which are very simple, like, I like to draw, I like to write, I like to speak, I like to be in conversation. And then how do you make that into something that seems active and productive in that other sense? And the big light bulb that went over my head here was that I thought, well, I need to make a small zine, a little brochure that goes with my paintings and exists as an art object just as much as the paintings, and it costs €1. It doesn't cost, you know, $100,000, and anybody can get it, and it has drawings and ideas and, It has things of other people and snippets of texts that I like, underlined, and interactions, and just stuff that I want to say that I don't necessarily say in a painting format. And it was a really important discovery. I don't think I'll want to do a show for the next foreseeable future without a zine.
Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
After the break, Juliet Koss, an associate professor of art history at Scripps College in California, tells the story of the Gesamtkunstwerk.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal. Art historian Juliet Koss just completed her first book. It's the first critical history of the German composer Richard Wagner's concept of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art, and its impact on European modernism. There are many references to the Gesamtkunstwerk in modern art. It's often used to describe a seamless melding of art forms that overwhelm the emotions, stifle rationality, and turn individuals into a powerless mass. The term has been applied to 1920s Berlin cinema and to Andy Warhol's factory scene in the 1960s. Koss's book Modernism After Wagner, due out this fall from the University of Minnesota Press, explores the history and legacy of Wagner's concept. She sits down with the architectural historian Wallace Miller to discuss the modern journey of the Gesamtkunstwerk.
Thanks for joining us, Juliet. My first question is a general one, but I think the central one. Why another book about Wagner?
This is actually not a book about Wagner per se. It's a book that focuses on his central idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk, or total work of art, the idea of bringing all the arts together in a grand combination that would remake the world. And it's a book that investigates the resonance of this concept within the history of modernism.
So there's no music?
There's lots of music playing in the background. I've actually joked about including a CD in the back flap. But I'm not a musicologist. I'm an art historian and an architectural historian specifically. So it's not a book about music per se. It is really a book about aesthetic theory, about the history of aesthetics and their relationship to politics.
You say that you're an architecture historian. And one thing that's really striking, of course, is that architects in this period really love to orient themselves with the term Gesamtkunstwerk. And that was certainly a way to elevate architecture to first place, saying that all the other arts formed a unity and fell under the umbrella of the total work of art. The Gesamtkunstwerk is similarity and integration. How does your book take this on? Do you find that there's a consistency throughout the book or over time in the idea that the Gesamtkunstwerk is linked with unity and integration?
Well, one thing that happens as you trace the history of a concept, and as I say, it goes from 1849 all the way up to World War II, you discover that the concept itself, the way that the word Gesamtkunstwerk is thrown around, the way it's treated, the way it's elaborated, actually changes drastically over time. So I've been very interested in the evolution of this history. Certainly when Wagner first proposed it, he was not talking about architecture per se. He was talking about the sister arts, as he put it, and those were poetry, music, and dance. And he was very explicit that those were the main three, although, of course, those stood for a larger understanding of the mixing of the arts more generally, which were not always so well defined. One of the things that I have argued is that as Wagner worked to create his own music dramas, as he called them, and worked to have a theater built to host his music dramas where they could be performed, architecture became increasingly important to him, so that by the time he had the theater at Bayreuth built, which was inaugurated in 1876, architecture was the art form that was like a chaperone for the sister arts. It was central, but it was hovering above them and keeping them all together. As for this question of integration, it's a really central question. Wagner argued that in bringing the arts together, he was actually freeing them to become, as he put it, more purely themselves, So that what we understand now, this term is thrown around all the time by people in the field of architecture, but I think in a lot of other disciplines as well, and certainly in art criticism, constantly this term is used, and it's usually not defined at all or very hazily defined. It's usually understood to mean a vast muddle, a complete mixing, a kind of phantasmagoria of artistic interrelation in which all of the individual elements are lost, in which they all give up their individual identities. In fact, that's not Wagner's original understanding, presentation of this concept. He was arguing for this kind of essential purity of each individual element that would become more refined in the process of combining with the other art forms.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. I'm Wallace Miller from the College of Design at the University of Kentucky. Another thing that the Gesamtkunstwerk seems to bring out is the idea of audience. I mean, certainly for Wagner, even though he talked about the arts or the sister arts, as you pointed out, he talks about poetry, music, and dance, which are all performative, and certainly at that time, performative more than one might have argued that architecture and art were. Now we can maybe argue differently, maybe because of this. How does the book confront the theme of the audience?
The effort to bring the arts together, as Wagner described it, and as I think it has been taken up since then in the ensuing century and a half, is paralleled. It's like a mirror for what goes on among the spectators. The individual spectators come into an auditorium, into a room, into some kind of space and encounter the work of art. And in encountering this total work of art, they too come together and become a group audience. So the book is really also, among other things, a history of how a group of individual spectators can be formed into a mass audience. And this happens, of course, against the background of the history of Germany between 1849 and World War II. So the question of how a group of individual spectators turns into a mass is a particularly loaded one when one is looking at German history at that time.
Yeah, it does sound, I mean, what it sounds like there is a certainly political current that also might be running through this book. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes, more than fair. I think there's politics to the history of the Gesamtkunstwerk, not only in the specifics of that history, but also in its reception. In other words, one of my arguments is that this is a term, Gesamtkunstwerk, which is thrown around all the time, and yet almost never defined, and certainly never historicized, never contextualized. And one of the reasons for that is itself, I think, the fact that it's a loaded German term that people are aware of but shy away from. So it's a word that's dropped. I like to say that there are two men responsible for this shying away from the concept of the Gesamtkunstwerk. There are two men who were fans of Wagner's music in the 1930s in Germany, and those two men are Hitler and Theodor Adorno. And both of them were enthusiasts, and both of them have affected the way we now think about this term. So it's generally the case when people think about Wagner, they are aware of him as Hitler's favorite composer, and that has generally caused art historians certainly to shy away from taking his work seriously in a theoretical way, because the first thing that comes up is, of course, oh, Wagner, wasn't he the notorious anti-Semite who was so beloved of Hitler? And the other side of that equation, Theodor Adorno, who wrote a brilliant and trenchant little book about Wagner in 1938, essentially argued that if one starts with Wagner, one ends up with Hitler. And I've written this book, although I didn't realize it while I was writing it, but I realized towards the end that I've written this book more or less to answer that complaint and to argue that if one begins with Wagner, one does not necessarily have to end up with Hitler, because one does not have to see history in this apocalyptic manner.
So how do we end up when we reach the last page of your book?
Well, we're still left with Adorno, and we're still left with the fact of fascism and fascist aesthetics. we're still left with the fact that Wagner did write a faintly horrifying essay called On Jewishness in Music in 1850. So my book in no way wishes to remove that from the historical record, any of that. At the same time, what I've wanted to do is leave a sense of the revolutionary origins of this concept which came as a utopian argument about the possibility of remaking the world through the unification of the arts, an argument that came following the disappointment of the failed revolution of 1849, the turning point which failed to turn in Europe. So the emancipatory potential of the notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk is what I have wanted to place at the center of this book, but also a sense that it is a utopian concept. It is a concept that can never exist in real life. And as such, it's something that is held aloft but is never achieved. So it's this sense of the history of the Gesamtkunstwerk as something to posit that will never be achieved.
Does this have a legacy? Can you talk about, although it's beyond the scope of the book, is there a way to think about the Gesamtkunstwerk in terms of its influence on contemporary art or architectural thinking?
Certainly, it's a concept that's thrown around with regard to the work of Andy Warhol, with regard to installation work, with regard to any kind of sound and light show, any melding of the arts. I think there's very little work in the 1960s, for example, that wouldn't benefit from an understanding of the notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk and its potential. At the same time, I do think that this idea of the interrelation of the arts, in which the sister arts are brought together and at the same time purified and made more purely themselves, picks up on another theme of modern art, by which I mean work since Wagner's time and continuing up to the present moment, in which medium specificity and disciplinary purity are central to painters, to those in the theater, to filmmakers, I think to anyone working in the arts today.
Juliet, could you spell Gesamtkunstwerk three times backwards?
Gerewtsnuktmaseg.
Juliet, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This has been the Berlin Journal, produced by the American Academy in Berlin and NPR worldwide. For more on the American Academy, please visit www.americanacademy.de. And for more on NPR Berlin, please visit www.nprberlin.de. Our guests today were journalist Adrian Nicole LeBlanc, novelist Donald Antrim, painter Amy Silman, and art historian Juliet Koss. Our guests were interviewed by Kerstin Stackemeyer of Karlia Gebauer Gallery in Berlin and Wallace Miller, an architectural historian at the University of Kentucky. Our production team is Bettina Warburg in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us.